Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Well, actually, it's another way of talking about why the subject literature and its public, with emphasis and its public, is an important one at this time. Because, in fact, when you begin to think about who the public for literature is, you begin to rethink what literature itself is.
What we've been doing in the seminar is looking first at the historical bases of the American political tradition of republicanism, and then trying to explain how that tradition was conveyed to ordinary people.
Literature and History in American High Schools, this week on Soundings. First on the program, Myra Jalen of the University of Pennsylvania and Leanne Cooper of Horizons Alternative High School in Wyoming, Michigan, discuss the teaching of literature in American high schools. Christine Heierman of Brandeis University and James Tripp of Glenwood City High School in Glenwood City, Wisconsin, will discuss the teaching of history in American secondary education. Also on Soundings this week, commentary from Richard Cashwell, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Leanne Cooper and Myra Jalen participated in the Center's 1989 summer seminars for high school instructors. Their topic was Writers and Readers, Literature and Its Publics. Here is Leanne Cooper.
The approach has been important to me because it's given me another way to address literature. I use classical literature in my classroom because that is our cultural heritage. And traditionally I've been looking at what the author is saying and how he is saying it. And this has given me more information on who he is saying it to, who he expects to be listening and reading his words.
Mm-hmm.
The works that we've read at the Institute have, for the most part, been new to me. I was familiar with Swift, although I had not read Gulliver's Travels. I was familiar with Shelley, although I had never read Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally unfamiliar with the Illuminated Books and William Blake. Part of the innate nature of man is the desire to create, and Frankenstein addresses where that takes us. It raises the question of, is it possible to go too far
mm-hmm.
in finding out who you really are and where you want to go? And that's one of the basic things that I try to give the students that I teach, is where do you really want to go? Who are you really? And reach for it. And if you fail, reach for it in a different way. And I don't warn them that this can be destructive, which is an issue that this novel raises.
Yeah, you're putting some dangerous questions there before young and tender minds. I salute you for your bravery. Myra Jalen, is that a risky thing to do?
Oh, it's not as risky as not doing it, I think. So
uh-huh.
that on the whole, it's certainly the risk to be taken. Can I add just another question to
sure.
this? I'm wondering, really, since we're talking about aspiring and trying and so on, what role do you think? I mean, we've been saying Shelley. Shelley will mean to most people
Percy Bysshe.
Bysshe Shelley.
Right.
In fact, it's not Percy Bysshe Shelley who wrote this one,
no.
But Mary Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that will play a role? How do you think your students will react to that? Probably never having even heard of Mary Shelley, will they?
Most likely not.
Mm-hmm.
And the students I work with are students who have not succeeded in another school. And so the idea of a woman succeeding will be no more amazing to them than what I tell them every day, which is that you can succeed. I don't think a woman author will be an issue at all. for my kids.
Is this an issue that that these kids need to know about? Is this one of these sort of subtextual kinds of things? The fact that a woman wrote this book, the fact that you are talking about writers and their audiences. Myra?
Oh, I think so. I think specifically in relation to Frankenstein, Frankenstein is about the creation of another human being. And
that's what moms and dads do all the time.
That's what moms and dads do, and moms and dads have often somewhat differing notions of what they're about in the doing of it. So that in the interpretation of the book itself, the fact that it was written by a woman needs to be taken into account. Indeed, one of the things that's been interesting that's emerged, in part to go back to what we were talking about before, from thinking about literature in relation to its audience, therefore to its context, is that for the first time really in the last 10 years, people have begun to take into consideration the fact that it was written by a woman before. That it was simply a generic text.
Let's turn our conversation, Myra Jalen, Leanne Cooper, to secondary teaching. Leanne, you teach at an alternative high school. Tell me what that means in terms of the way kids are absorbing literature. Tell me about the perils and rewards of the literary enterprise in our secondary schools from your standpoint.
Alternative schools are designed to give the student more choice. For whatever reason, and they are numerous, the traditional setting just didn't work for these students.
Are we talking about discipline? What do you have in mind?
Discipline, what they will study, how they will study it. Of course, all of this needs to be guided. They can't just simply decide from what they know what they need to know. But rather than handing them a book list or a set of words or whatever that you've decided is important for them to know, you're asking them.
Mm-hmm.
You ask them to help you set up the class. At Horizons, the students interview teachers to be hired. They interview students coming in. They've set up the school rules.
Uh-huh.
They sit on a judicial board to decide what kind of consequences to hand out for breaking those school rules. So in dealing with literature, the students are hungry to see how other people have organized their lives and their societies, because that's what we're asking those students to do, and they're capable of it. So they're telling us something. And nationwide, there's a 25% dropout rate. There are a lot of young people telling us something. We don't want to hear that.
Myra Jalen, talk to me for a few minutes about the kinds of kids, not specifically the students that Leanne Cooper teaches, but the kinds of students and the sort of preparation that they are getting as they come to you. Here, you're an English professor at the mm-hmm. University of Pennsylvania. We have a lot of moaning and groaning going on in this country about cultural literacy and...
Yeah, I think the certainly there are problems. I think no one who teaches at the college level would deny that there are real problems in the preparation of the students. And preparation of students makes it sound as if all we're interested in getting the you know properly set up product to work with a little bit longer. But in fact, it's really about the sort of people that we meet in our classrooms and who they are at the age of, 18, 19, when they arrive in college. And there are problems. But I think, in fact, you use the phrase cultural literacy, and I think that that's a phrase which has come to mean, to define that problem in ways that I think I myself would not want to stress quite so much.
How would you couch it?
Well, I think cultural literacy seems to imply that there is a content, there is a specific list of things that they don't know, mm-hmm. that they have not read this and that, and that if we have them read this and that, things will be better. I think the problem is... larger but and also narrower and but altogether more basic, and that is that and this goes along I think very much with what Leanne was saying before. For me the problem has been when I've had students in my classes that it's not so much that there are things that they don't know, is that they're not at all sure how to think about things, about they don't know really what it would mean to know those things if they were to know them. That is, the problem is really on the level of analyzing, of thinking about problems, of noting problems, of asking questions. And I would put the emphasis on that asking of questions. And in that sense, it seems to me that the alternative high school movement has things to give to the whole of the high school movement, because I suspect from all the descriptions I've heard of it, and certainly from Leanne's, that what it does is stress the asking of questions, that it puts the students in the position of asking questions. It says to them, before you can learn anything, you have to ask a question. And that, I think, is where the basic weaknesses are greater.
Well, using that as a jumping off point, Myra Jalen, Leanne Cooper, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Leanne, is it too far-fetched to think that a topic like literature and its audiences will help you as a teacher in getting, as Myra says, kids to learn to think, not just unscrewing the tops of their heads and bubbling in the facts, but the analytical, the creative, the critical even, that sort of thing?
It will help because it's one of the approaches you need. It's more than just reading a work or a list of works in the survey course and being able to say who wrote what and when, which is what your simple competency test will measure, and then you can be a literate person, which has very little to do with what authors you know. It has a great deal more to do with how able you are to bring yourself to the work, to understand the work, to dig through the work. Part of that is understanding the audience that he wrote to.
You keep saying he. I think that's it. Myra?
That is interesting.
I'll give you the last word here.
Okay, and I'll just say she, and that will take care of it. I think that there's to bring it back to the student, which is ultimately what we're talking about, and it's what we're thinking about. I think that the thing about teaching from the perspective of the relation between literature and its public or its audience also has a way of referring back to the reader, making the reader self-conscious. That is, if we're going to talk about audience, and if we're going to make a problem of audience, if we're going to say the definition of the audience is a part of the definition of the work, then that places emphasis on the student and the student's own sense of himself or herself and herself as a thinking, reading, understanding, rethinking being, so that it seems to me that as a subject, it gives us a handle on the fundamental problem, which is making the student aware of herself as a reader.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to Myra Jalen of the University of Pennsylvania and Leanne Cooper of Horizons Alternative High School in Wyoming, Michigan. Leanne Cooper and Myra Jalen participated in the Center's 1989 Summer Seminar for High School Teachers. In a moment, a discussion about the teaching of history in American high schools. Before that, however, here is commentary from Richard Cashwell, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Right now, it's relatively quiet, but every spring, the work I do takes on something of a frantic character. Not long after we send the letters notifying students about their acceptance or rejection to the university, our phones really start to ring. The calls reflect anger, sometimes frustration, oftentimes confusion. Many parents refuse to talk to anyone but me simply because my name is on all of the letters that go to the students. Last year we had about 17,000 applications for the freshman class and only 3,200 slots. And that number is established by the university's administration based on enrollment projections. Obviously, most of the students that apply for admission do not get in, and I catch the brunt of the anger when kids don't, because my job consists of carrying out the policies that govern the admission to the institution. If I had the choice, I'd probably double the size of the freshman class every year and admit all qualified students and therefore make fewer people mad. But that isn't going to happen because we do have enrollment restrictions. In the words of one of my mentors, as long as you work in the admissions office, you're going to be treated like a red-headed stepchild, and you'd better get used to it because that's the way it is. In response to the difficult situation of student selection. I think it's fair to say that just about all offices of undergraduate admission around the country need more money and they need more manpower. They need these things so that they can do a better job of communicating their policies to their publics, particularly to high school students' parents, and to high schools, particularly to the guidance counselors. Almost all of our colleges and universities would be better to step up their recruiting efforts, but recruiting in the sense that they need to be getting better information to students and their parents about the policies of selection. The admissions departments need to place greater emphasis on an applicant's personal characteristics, their leadership qualities in making their selections. They need to stay away from a doctrinaire use of class ranks, test scores, and grade averages. They particularly need to improve their sensitivity in dealing with rejected applicants and to be able to offer rejected students some hope and some alternatives. But rejection is a fact, and it is likely to continue so long as high school students fail to prepare themselves adequately in their secondary years for what college faculties expect. What, in fact, high school students and their parents need to know as they sit down over the next few months to write letters of application to colleges and universities is what really should be expected of them in terms of preparation. All students, college-bound or not, need to be liberally educated in the classical sense in high school. In my opinion, one cannot properly function in our democratic society without this broad-based education at the secondary level. And I say that simply because most students will not go to college. Finally, students should better prepare themselves in the areas of English, literature, writing, and social science. Even bright students cannot write effectively when they come to college, and their knowledge of geography and of other cultures is almost non-existent. They really need to prepare themselves in these areas. The main thing to remember is there are a lot of very good colleges and universities in the United States, and many, many can meet the needs of students. All students do not need to go to the few name schools.
Richard Cashwell is Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on American Secondary Education continues now. My guests are Christine Heyerman of Brandeis University and James Tripp of Glenwood City High School in Glenwood City, Wisconsin. Christine Heyerman and James Tripp participated in the Center's 1989 summer seminar for high school teachers. Their topic is Republics, Ancient to Modern.
Jim Tripp, tell me about the kinds of things that you have been reading with Christine Heyerman and your colleagues in this summer seminar. Name a couple of titles for me. Tell me why you think they're important. How are they important to you as a teacher, and how might they be important to your students?
I'm going to start out with basically your last question, how these things have been important to me, and translate that to my students. And I'm going to start that by saying that my students generally do not have a very good idea of where they fit in to the governing of America.
Is this what's called cultural illiteracy?
It may be related to that. I'm not entirely sure it's the same thing.
Uh-huh.
But they find it very difficult to put themselves into a position where they can have a sense that they are somehow in control, even on a local political level. The common response of my students to an issue of the day is that they cannot do anything about it.
Therefore, why should they be interested?
Therefore, why should they be interested? Why should they try?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to relate back to the first part of your question, the kinds of things that we've been reading, starting with Aristotle and working our way up through Machiavelli and Locke and then Thomas Paine, have given me a better sense of the beliefs of common citizens in relationship to how they are governed. My job then is to translate that somehow for my students, to give them some sort of an idea of the kind of beliefs, the framework of beliefs that they fit into. The very nature of a republic is one in which the citizens, and in our times, the citizen meaning virtually everybody, has a stake in the outcome of issues. They have a responsibility to direct those issues, and I guess I see my function as one of being a facilitator. Mm-hmm. It's my job, as I see it in public education, to make my students aware of their position in a Republican government. And I think these readings have given me a better philosophical background so that when my students have questions, I'm hopeful that I'll be better able to answer them.
Christine Hireman, how do you walk the fine line, or in fact, do you walk the fine line, between what the chronology of the notion of republics, ancient to modern, and the criticism of these republics? Where does the emphasis fall?
Well, I think the emphasis is less philosophical in the way that your question suggests than it is historical. We're not so concerned with the question of why republics have risen and fallen, but more the content of republican thought as it's changed over time. And differing views of what the purpose of government is. Is government intended to ennoble people, mm-hmm. Which would be the classical ideal, the ancient ideal, or is government government's function to protect liberty and property, which is the American tradition?
Well, let's pursue that for a moment, Christine Hireman and Jim Tripp. Has it improved? Are we triumphantly looking back and saying, hey, this is as good as it's going to get? It isn't going to get any better than this. What is your sense of that, Jim?
I certainly hope we are not looking back from an apex. I would certainly hope that our future and our outlook on the future is much more optimistic. Given some of the headlines in the paper in the past couple of years, a person has to wonder how optimistic we can be about a future of a country, of a republic, in which so large a percent of the population seems to be uninterested. On the other hand, though, we have achieved some things, and again, looking at the recent headlines about the abortion decision by the Supreme Court, the Oliver North trial, the situation with the students in China, world situations involving republics, I think that we have come a long way, and I personally look forward with optimism. There was a program done on public television a while ago focusing on education, the name of which I forget right now, but in one of the segments they interviewed high school students as to their plans and what they had done to prepare for it, and I think that segment of that program very well illustrated what my basic problem is, and that is this. I don't think my students have a very good concept of the relationship between the amount of effort and time and work that they put into education and what they expect to get out of it. My students are fairly typical in that they seem to think that everything will be all right and that somehow they will gain the knowledge and the expertise and the abilities that they need to be successful in the world without necessarily investing anything of themselves in it. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that I have a very difficult time facing with my students is because I live in a small rural community, it's difficult for me to open up to them the possibilities of a greater outside world. They tend to be fairly self-satisfied with their own little corner of the world because it's a very nice place to live, and it's difficult to open up to them the realities of a much bigger universe.
Well, speaking of those wider worlds, here Christine Hireman is a professor at Brandeis. You certainly
I'm not
live.
Sure that that's the wider world.
Well, tell me about, I'll ask you to offer some loving criticism, Christine. Here you've got a high school teacher sitting next to you. What kind of job is this guy doing? What kinds of students are you getting? Again, maybe Brandeis is not representative, probably is not, but what is your sense of this, your own experience and your colleagues in college teaching?
Yeah, what I'm finding is it's something that mystifies me. I don't understand how this can be happening. I would say that on the whole, in the last 5 to 7 years, the quality of my students has improved substantially. Their ability to write, their ability to reason and analyze, their basic cultural background, all of these things, I think, are showing a marked improvement. The reason that this mystifies me is that everything I hear from high school teachers suggests that they are being asked to do more and more and are not receiving adequate compensation for the extra duties that they are assuming.
Money. It is coming down many times to money.
Oh, I think definitely. Mm-hmm. And I can't understand how teachers can bear the burden of administration that they are asked to assume, all the bureaucratic duties that are involved in being a teacher today, how they can do the kind of counseling of individual students that's expected of them, in many cases sort of substituting for a family structure that's either weak or that isn't there at all, and how they can be doing such an effective job of teaching young people. I think that the improvement is real in the preparation of the students that I see at the university level, and I think that has come out of the hide of our educators at the secondary level. And one of the great injustices is that they aren't being recompensed for the kinds of duties that society is asking them to assume.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation about the center's 1989 summer seminars for high school teachers. My guests were Christine Heyerman of Brandeis University and James Tripp of Glenwood City High School in Glenwood City, Wisconsin. Apropos of the discussions this week on Soundings, from mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor two seminars for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, my guest will be Eli Evans, president of the Charles Revson Foundation. Our topic will be Eli Evans' biography, Judah P. Benjamin, the Jewish Confederate. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 478. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Late November and early December mark an anniversary for the Provisional Articles of Peace, which ended the American War of Independence from Great Britain. They were signed at the end of November 1782. Happy birthday to the Monroe Doctrine, promulgated 166 years ago this week. The Monroe Doctrine warned European powers not to interfere in the American hemisphere, north and south. The game of bingo is 60 years old this week. It was introduced at the end of November 1929 by Edwin S. Lowe. Next week marks an anniversary for an event that many historians called the birth of the modern civil rights movement. Mrs. Rosa Parks refused to sit in the back of a bus in Montgomery, Alabama in early December 1955. Finally, late November and early December birthdays include Mary Walker Edwards, the first female surgeon in the United States Army, and Louisa May Alcott, the American author, both born in 1832. William Blake, the English poet and artist, born in 1757. The American author Samuel Langhorne Clemens, born in 1835. And Winston Churchill, the British statesman, born in late November 1874. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Teachers on Teaching, this week on Soundings. Scholars from Brandeis University and the University of Pennsylvania, together with secondary instructors from Michigan and Wisconsin, discussed the 1989 summer seminars for high school teachers, recently sponsored by the National Humanities Center. And the Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill provides commentary. Teachers on Teaching, this week on Soundings.